I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome back to Radio Times. Farmers and ranchers in many states across the country are getting older and considering retirement. That wouldn't be a problem if there were a new generation or two ready to take their place. But unfortunately, there's a shortage of new and younger farmers, and that is a problem for the country. The U.S. Department of Agriculture is publicizing this issue and encouraging young people to choose careers in agriculture. And the point person for this effort is our guest, Kathleen Merrigan, Deputy Secretary of the USDA. And nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hey, it's great to be here and talking about one of the most important issues that we could chat on.
Well, that's, in a sense, why you are here. What is the average age of an American farmer these days?
Well, the average age is closing on 60, and we know that for every farm operator under the age of 35, we have six over the age of 65.
Wow. And are there certain parts of the country where farmers are older than others?
New Mexico has the distinction of having the oldest farmers in the country. It all is close, though. You know, we're talking in a range between 50 6-point-something to 60 years of age. So it's generally a problem across the board. And I know in my travels, as I try to get outside of the Beltway regularly to see how USDA programs are working, I meet up with farmers who are in their 80s, still working the land because they haven't quite figured out the transition for the property, for their operation. There's not an easy pathway, and so they're just plugging on, keeping things operating until they have a solution.
Does that mean that their children are not getting into the farm business?
Well, in some cases it is. You know, people have worked really hard on the farm, and while we are now having record farm income and exports are at an all-time high, things are fairly good on the farm. I always hate to say that because that's in the aggregate. There are individual farms in the country that aren't doing well, but over the years, over the decades, there have been highs and lows. And so some farm families have worked really hard to send their kids off to college, and they're not anxious to have them come back to the farm. What I'm saying to them is this is a new era. American agriculture is critically important. We have growing world population. We're going to need increased food. We have all kinds of challenges like climate change. And so we really need our best and the brightest to come back home to the farm, into the ranch, and make a go of it. And we're going to need people who are not from the farm family, who are coming brand new to agriculture, who come from the cities even.
And I want to pick up on all that. And we're talking about farms, generally speaking. Are we also generally talking about family farms, smaller farms, as opposed to the, you know, the large, small agribusiness-type farms?
Well, the reality is most farms in this country are small family farms. But, yes, we're talking about small and mid-sized farms. The large farms have a lot of professional staff, and they can hire, but there's a big cost also to losing farmland that people don't realize. So it's not just the food production capacity and what it does to rural America and these small towns when they depopulate, but keeping farmland and farming is really important for water quality and clean air and aesthetics, the view. There are a lot of reasons that we see farms leaving in the peri-urban, the suburban areas, because they just can't make a go of it given the property values. And yet people crave to be near a farm. You know, there's only about 1% of Americans that are currently on the farm and ranch. And I'm seeing this growing wave of enthusiasm for knowing who your farmer is, knowing where your food comes from, learning more about how it's produced. So I think that there is this renaissance of interest in American agriculture, and I think it's a perfect time to re-engage, for young people to re-engage working lands and saying, hey, this is a career for me.
I know there was a blog that really got you going, and this was a blog that said that the number one useless college degree in this country is in agriculture, and I know you're pushing back on that. But it tells us something, I think, about either the mythology or kind of a stereotype that we have about farming and farmers.
I think so. I think people say it's turning back the clock, but modern farming uses a lot of modern technology. In fact, you know, a lot of farmers are in their cabs and perhaps in their tractors listening to the show on the radio in their cabs that's air-conditioned, and they're being moved around through a global positioning satellite system. So agriculture has marched on in a lot of interesting ways.
I wonder, too, about what can get more people thinking about farming. And we shouldn't sugarcoat this. And our show is really about some of the challenges of being a farmer, not, you know, in any time, but certainly today. What do you see as if someone is going to realistically think about being a farmer, what do they need to think about?
Well, the biggest challenge, I think, is money. The capital costs of entering into American agriculture are tough. I mean, the average combine costs $250,000.
Wow.
A tractor is more than your first car. So these sort of things are just mind-blowing for young people. The cost of farmland now, prime acreage in Iowa, you might be paying $18,000, $20,000 an acre in some places. So it's gotten crazy,
right.
But we're trying to do things to help. I think with the growing public interest in locally grown food, we're doing a lot more to help farmers enter into those local food markets. So if you're starting out, you can start small. You can sell direct to your customers, be it at a farmer's market, through a CSA, to a farm-to-school program. There are different things that you can do that we're trying to facilitate, and that means that you don't have to put out so much money up front. Now, some of those young people who begin in the local marketplace will stay their whole careers in the local marketplace, and others will use it as a stepping stone to scale up in size. But I think that's the biggest challenge. We just announced last week a new microloan program at our Farm Services Agency. It's a proposed rule, but I'm very optimistic. It's gotten great reviews so far. So that the paperwork to borrow money from the U.S. Department of Agriculture for small sums under $35,000 will go through a massive cutting exercise. So it'll be much easier for people to access low amounts of money. My boss has always said, particularly when it comes to a rural development program, why is the paperwork the same for a municipality to borrow $100,000 as it is $10 million? Like, there should be some sort of size-appropriate approach. And so in our Farm Service Agency, as it relates to farm operating loans, we're working on that right now.
I'm thinking about the farm bill. It's a big, sprawling bill, obviously. But one of the critiques is that it focuses on these big commodity crops. Do you think the farm bill can do more to help either get young and new farmers into agriculture or to help keep people in this line of work?
Certainly. The bill that's being deliberated in the Congress right now, it's passed the Senate committee. It may go to the Senate floor in June.
Mm-hmm.
The House doesn't have a bill out of committee yet. The Secretary and I have been arguing that this issue of beginning farmers should be a center stage issue in the context of the Farm Bill. We have some tools in our toolbox here at USDA, but not enough to really meet the challenge head on. There are some good gains in the Senate Farm Bill, but we've got a long ways to go before they cross the finish line with that legislation, so time will tell.
Mm. We're talking about the shortage of farmers, but should we be worried that if there are not enough farmers, we're not going to be able to feed the country or even the world?
Well, right now, we're actually in very good shape. One farmer in this country on average feeds 155 people. We're more productive than we've ever been, and our exports are higher than they've ever been. So we're not only able to feed this country, but we're able to help others. Mm-hmm. Now, we're going to continue to have environmental challenges. Water is a global issue of great concern, and agriculture is the largest user of water. Climate change is going to stress out our crops, and again, that growing world population. So we can't afford to rest on our laurels, to say everything's good and we'll just stay in cruise control. No, not at all. We need to repopulate to stay where we're at, And then we may be in the future seeing all kinds of new things in agriculture, because agriculture is a dynamic field. That's what's so exciting about it. I love all the science that goes on and all the new developments week after week. But, you know, I see down the road we're going to have more vertical farming and urban farming, and it may look a lot different than it does today. And I think diversity is a good thing. That's okay.
And could we feed the world if we all became organic farmers?
Well, a lot of the farmers, the majority of the farmers in the world already are organic, because in developing countries, they don't have access to a lot of the inputs that that we have here in this country and in developed countries. I think that organic is one strategy, but it's not going to be the only strategy for feeding that world food population. We're going to look at genetic engineering. I mean, there's a lot of anticipation of drought-tolerant crops that could be grown in sub-Saharan Africa that would really allow food production at a whole different level than is currently achieved. And just regular traditional farming, there are a lot of parts of the world that just technical expertise alone would make a difference. So the challenges are multifaceted and will require multifaceted strategies.
Have you ever worked on a farm?
Have I ever worked on a farm?
Yeah.
Only temporarily.
Meaning?
I grew up next door to a farm. I know what hard work it is to be a farmer. My dad worked in a farm supply store, but I've always been on the policy angle of things.
Do you belong to a CSA?
I belong to a CSA, yeah.
My husband
takes care of all that stuff, but I know that that we get that, you know, weekly delivery, and we're all very happy.
And, I mean, we're talking about this shortage, and obviously your department and you are interested in trying to get more people into farming. We have about a minute before we have to say goodbye, but do you think you're making progress on that front?
We do, and we are currently in the process of doing the 2012 Census of Agriculture. We do one every 5 years, and in about another year we'll be able to aggregate that data and know a bit more. But we know that there are young people coming in, that more women than men, and that they tend to be very interested in alternative production methodologies like organic and local.
Well, on that note, my thanks to you for joining us today on Radio Times, getting our conversation started. Kathleen Merrigan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And she is the Deputy Secretary of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. In fact, before coming to the USDA, she was an assistant professor and director of the Agriculture, Food, and Environment Graduate Program at the Friedman School of Nutrition Science and Policy at Tufts University. We have Jennifer Brodsky waiting to join us after this very short break. She's Managing Director for Longview Center for Agriculture, and we'll be talking about farming and finding out whether people want to be farmers. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
The Richard Stockton College of New Jersey supports WHYY and offers graduate degree programs designed to prepare graduates for professional careers in business, education, and the sciences, with convenient course schedules to help students grow academically and advance their careers. For more information, stockton.edu/grad school. That's stockton.edu/grad school. Stockton College, New Jersey's distinctive public college.
Bring your appetite, food fanatics, as WHYY celebrates some of the region's greatest culinary minds with Best of the Chefs, a two-hour tasting featuring an array of area restaurants, breweries, and businesses. They'll serve up their tastiest treats, and your votes decide who is crowned Best of the Chefs in several mouth-watering categories. Also, a raffle, beer garden, and live music, Thursday, June 21st. Tickets at whyy.org/member experience.
WHYY is proudly supported by the new University Medical Center of Princeton at Plainsboro. This new hospital is now open. It was designed with all single-patient rooms and innovations that may help improve healing and lower infections. Features include a rapid response emergency room and physicians from the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia to care for children. The new University Medical Center of Princeton at Plainsboro, redefining care. Now open. More at princetonhcs.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Farmers markets are popping up all over the country, and many people are buying shares in CSAs for this season, as they have done in the past. But with all this talk about eating locally and community-supported agriculture, as we just heard, the USDA is warning of a coming shortage of farmers. Joining us now is Jennifer Brodsky, and she's the Managing Director for the Longview Center for Agriculture. It's a project of Greener Partners, whose mission is connecting communities through food, farming, and education. And Jennifer Brodsky, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you here. And we were just talking with Kathleen Merrigan about this farmer shortage across the country. Are we experiencing one here in the Philadelphia area, do you think?
I think that we're experiencing a boom, but I think overall, I think you're seeing a shift from traditional family farms that have been sold for development, and we're not seeing the same progression from one generation to the next. So we're seeing new farmers entering the field here in this region.
And CSAs, I'm sure that that's a big part of some of these new farmers. How does that work?
A CSA.
Yes.
A CSA works. What you're doing as a CSA member is you're actually buying into the farm. You're a member of that farm, and you're taking the same amount of risk that the farmer would. So you actually pay in advance for your share for the year, and you share the bounty of the harvest every week.
Well, as Kathleen Merrigan was saying, that there are, for a lot of farmers, a lot of upfront costs. If you want to buy a tractor or you want to buy land, that's just a lot of money up front. How are local, I guess, farmers addressing that? How do you deal with that?
Well, I think CSA is actually the way that a lot of new farmers in this region are dealing with those upfront costs, because they are able to secure those funds in advance of the season with participation from the members to pay for their seed, to pay for their employees for the year. But I think that CSA model, I think everyone is not a CSA member. No. So there's a lot of other opportunities, and I think that there's some interesting innovative programs that are happening, but I think that capital upfront capital expenditure is the most difficult.
Well, and I would think also getting the produce or the meats or whatever, eggs, to the market. I mean, there's the upfront cost, and then you need to have customers.
Well, a sophisticated marketing strategy, I think, is critical for success. Depending on one particular marketing avenue is, I think, doesn't work for most farmers. And I've seen, actually, even in the last few years, a real acknowledgement of that from smaller scale farmers who are CSA farmers or market farmers, making sure that they are able to accommodate several marketing streams, including wholesale, which is a new conversation, I think, for a lot of smaller farmers.
I'm thinking, too, of restaurants, maybe schools, maybe institutions, zoos. I don't know. I'm just throwing out a whole bunch of ideas of people that might be interested in this produce, for instance.
I think that there's a huge interest in eating regionally, eating locally, and there's definitely a challenge for us as farmers moving from direct to consumer, you're my CSA member, to selling to the zoo, as you mentioned, or selling to a hospital. There's different expectations. There's different price points. And it really takes a sophisticated strategy to make sure that you're still making money on that bunch of carrots that you're selling.
I'm sure you've run across people that have very romantic notions about farming. And I don't know if it's part of your job is to take them off that particular pedestal, but this is hard work.
I think in some ways the opposite. I think continuing to inspire new farmers, if that passion is there, then That is the most important thing that we can see in a new farmer, because starting as a first-generation farmer is difficult. It's a lifelong pursuit. So what we try to do is we really try to continue to inspire that excitement, but also pepper it with some doses of reality. at our farm, for instance, we have a 120-acre farm, and we have several farm managers, and they participate in our P&L meetings and our budgeting process mm-hmm. because it's important for them to right. see the reality of what it takes to run a farm.
That's a big farm, 120 acres.
It is a big farm.
What do you grow?
We grow a large variety of vegetables and tree fruits and soft fruits as well. And we have chickens for eggs, and we'll be incorporating some livestock. It's a highly diversified organic farm.
And I know you're not supposed to ask people how much money they make, but can you make money in the farm business?
I think you can. I think you absolutely can. I think that some of our guests that are coming up, I know that John Good and I have spoken about this in detail, and I think he's very committed to, just as you would in any other business, really understanding what model for success makes the most sense for your individual farm. And I think, but being very careful to be confident in making decisions and moving in different directions if the numbers just right. aren't there.
Well, I know we have John Good waiting in the wings, but let me get Susan from Cape May to join us. She called us up. I want to get her call on, and then we'll get John Good in our conversation. And Susan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, this is a great conversation.
Thank
and it
you.
Touches me very personally. I have a son who is at graduate school at Washington State University in organic horticulture, researching a fungus that's attacking the Idaho potato. We are not a farming family. Wish we were. I think our connection is going to start with him. And I guess what I would hope, and I didn't certainly have no, didn't do everything right as a parent. I did a lot wrong, but I got the kids out, and I got the kids in the woods, and I got identifying plants, and got them to feel like we have a strong connection with everything. With the food we eat, with nature, and I'm just thinking that's strongly lacking mm-hmm. with our young people, and maybe that's a good beginning for a lot of the kids today. That's what I would recommend anyway.
Fair enough, Susan. Thanks for calling in. Yes, go ahead, Jennifer.
Susan, I think that's a great point. And actually, as part of Greener Partners, our mission is sort of twofold. Where our goal is to train the next generation of farmers, but it's also connect with the community. And without that, those individual connections, and we see that every day on our farms, kids are, they're so much quicker to pick it up
yes,
than we are, right? We forgot.
Well, they're natural scientists,
yeah,
don't you think?
We've forgotten what it's like to bend down and pick up a carrot out of the ground, and kids pick it up immediately. And I think that what I'm seeing is parents bringing kids to the farm, sort of knowing intuitively that it's important to mm-hmm. reconnect their kids with food and with nature, but the kids are the ones that take it to the next level. They come home and say, I want to make that sweet potato dip that I tasted at one of our programs. And that's really inspiring and critical.
And I'm also thinking, in Philadelphia, there are a lot of local gardens and farm centers, that this is an urban phenomenon as well.
Urban and suburban, absolutely.
Let me just clear my voice and reintroduce you. That's Jennifer Brodsky, Managing Director for the Longview Center for Agriculture. It's a project of Greener Partners, and she told me their mission is connecting communities through food, farming, and education. And joining us now, as promised, is John Good. He owns and operates Quiet Creek Farm with his wife, Amy Good, in Kutztown, Pennsylvania. It's an 8-acre organic vegetable farm. They have something like 185 CSA members located at the Rodale Institute. And John Good, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Excuse me, and lines open at 1-888-477-9499. So, John, how did you get interested in farming?
I took a circuitous route. My wife and I were both environmental studies majors in college. We were interested in environmental education, and I had a second major in English literature in college. And
perfect.
Interestingly enough, I took a one-credit community service project in an environmental literature class. And for that project, I worked on a CSA in Western Massachusetts, the Food Bank Farm, which I wasn't aware of it at the time, but was one of the first and largest CSAs in the country. And through kind of a semester of volunteering there, I've just sort of became enamored with the work. And the following year, both my wife and I worked on that farm and then interned on another before we decided that this was what we wanted to do with our lives.
And this is an 8-acre organic vegetable farm that you and your wife run?
That's correct.
And what's been good this year so far?
Most things have been good. Knock on wood, it's been a good growing season so far. So we're enthusiastic at this point, but I don't like to talk too much about it until the season's over.
Exactly.
I do believe in jinxes. So I don't say much about it. But so far, so good is what we're saying right now.
In fact, as you're talking, I'm thinking about July of last year, which was a very, very hot month. And then,
sure,
of course, all those torrential rains in August. And here I am talking about it. But I'm curious about, if you had fantasies, John, that you had to, in a sense, get rid of as you and your wife were working on this farm.
Yeah, sure. We did a lot. Actually, on the second farm we worked on, part of what we did was develop a plan, a management plan for what our future farm was going to look like and how our business was going to look like. And I looked back on that plan about a year or two ago and just found myself laughing out loud, mm-hmm, at all the things I said I was going to do and needed to do, you know, as part of our business. I mean, we were going to grow vegetables, we were going to have peaches, we were going to have cows, we were going to have pigs, you know, we were going to do everything. And you know, and luckily, you know, I'm a conservative person, and we decided to start with just vegetables because that's what we knew. And we've never really gone beyond that point. You know, we've realized that this alone is as much as we can handle if we really want to do it well, which is what is really important to us. We don't want to take on more and more tasks and do them kind of halfway. We want to do one thing really well. So as time has gone on, we've actually just concentrated on our vegetable production, and we actually rely on other farmers in our community to supply our farm and our CSA members with maybe their meat and dairy products and those sorts of things.
Well, Jennifer, let me go back to you, and even picking up on what John was just saying there, in terms of the kind of skills and tools that someone has to have to be a farmer today, what do you think they are?
I think hard work is probably the one that I would put at the top of the list, and dedication. I think business skills. I think the farming piece of it itself, physically managing the land and the crops, is requires so many different skills, understanding plant biology. And I think that also there's a huge management piece to it as well, managing the people who work for you, managing your members and those relationships that you rely on so closely. And as John mentioned, relationships with other farmers, I think, and have continued to become more and more important for us as a community in order to be successful.
Do you feel that way, John, that you're not competing with other farmers, you're in this together?
Yeah, and particularly in this sector of agriculture, you know, there is no competitiveness. You know, we're all open to sharing what we do and helping each other get better at sort of growing the local food movement in general. We're not at a state yet where anybody is really working against each other.
And you have, what, about 185 CSA members?
Yes, we do.
And as I was saying to Jennifer, you know, you're not supposed to ask people if they can make a living or not, but have you been able to make a living?
Yeah, we have. You know, my wife and I, we own our home. We have two cars. We have two children. You know, we live, I think, a fairly comfortable life. Now, you know, in that respect, there's a lot of things and luxuries that we don't have, but that's as much by choice as by anything. But, yeah, we make our living farming. We have some time off in the winter. I don't work a second job. Mm-hmm. Neither does my wife. And, you know, again, you're not going to get rich, but you can make a good living or a very satisfying living from doing it.
And that's John Good. He and his wife, Amy Good, own a farm called Quiet Creek Farm in Kutztown, Pennsylvania. And also with us, Jennifer Brodsky, Managing Director for the Longview Center for Agriculture. We're talking about farming and what it takes to be a farmer these days. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. John, I'm curious about what's a typical day for you?
A typical day, well, just before, I was harvesting this morning. I just ran back to the house to take the interview. So we are harvesting most days now from first thing in the morning till about lunchtime. And that's just bringing produce into our barn and washing it and packing it in our walk-in coolers really every day for the CSA pickup. And then the afternoon is always changing. An organic farm, your biggest job is always weeding is the first thing we're doing. And then followed by tractor work and greenhouse work we have to do a fair amount of. And then, you know, it varies very much seasonally. You know, later on in the summer, I'm sure we'll be doing lots of irrigating. And it's just kind of an endless list of projects trying to keep up with what the season and the crops are demanding is always changing.
And I'm going to let you do a pitch for organic. Why organic?
I think why, that's a good question. There's lots of great advantages to organic. But I think I'll say, at least from why I came into organic farming, is because, you know, I came to it almost more from the sense of the health of our total living environment, even so much than the sense of the health of eating the food. You know, being an environmental science major, I realized that agriculture is, you know, one of our largest uses of land in the world. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what we put on that soil and what ends up in our water has, you know, massive impacts for our whole society. And so I believed in organic as sort of a solution to that problem, and became a farmer really as along those same lines, as that wanting to do the work of being a solution to the problems that we've seen develop over the years from, let's just say, non-organic methods.
Our first guest, Kathleen Merrigan, talked about farmers in this country, one farmer feeding 155 people. I think that was basically what she was saying, Jennifer. And you, I have to say, you had a response to something to that particular statement coming from her.
I thought it was surprising. It was an interesting statistic that, excuse me, that I had never heard before. And I was thinking about our farm.
Right.
We have a year-round market on our farm, so we sell local produce from our farm and other farms year-round, as well as 180-person CSA. 180
households, right?
CSA.
I hear you.
So it was interesting to me to think about the. I mean, we're expecting 35,000 people to come to our farm over this next year, and I was thinking about how many from one farm, how many lives we're impacting, and how many people we're feeding, and it was a really surprising statistic for me to hear.
You think it's, I mean, from your perspective, a lot more than 150?
Well, I think this type of farm, or the type of farm that John and Amy are running, it's obviously a different scale. And so a large farm that's thousands of acres that's growing corn, well, that corn may not be going, that corn cob isn't going to a person. It's being processed into another form of food. So it's not having the same impact.
And John, is this a good part of the U.S. to have a farm? I mean, the temperature, the land, the climate, all of that, the rainfall.
Yeah, it is. You know, there's always its challenges, but we're kind of, you know, right in the middle here in this region. So it's nice. You know, we have a nice warm summer growing season. We have a cool spring and a cool fall, and then, you know, and really importantly too is having a good winter, because that helps break the life cycle of a lot of insects and disease problems you may have. So this region, and also I should mention too, like culturally, you know, the Philadelphia suburbs are an extremely rich agricultural region in terms of farm businesses and farm supply businesses, because of sort of the Lancaster County, you know, manufactures small farm equipment for the world. So I think we're a uniquely positioned area in that way, in terms of having both a good climate and really good sort of technical resources available.
And John, we have to say goodbye to you. Do you want your kids to be farmers?
You know, I would like them to, but I'm not going to put any pressure on them for that. You know, I want my kids to do what they would like. But, you know, my wife and I, we do lease our farm right now at the Rodale Institute, and it's an unbelievable situation because we're in the middle of a 330-acre certified organic research farm.
Wow.
But one of our dreams, you know, and beyond that, is still someday to own our own farm. And from my perspective, to at least give my children the chance to inherit a farm, which is something that I never had. And then if they choose that direction, I'd like to offer them that opportunity to kind of restore that chain of succession in farmland that you've been talking about today.
Well, John Good, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Okay, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. He and his wife, Amy Good, operate Quiet Creek Farm, and that's in Kutztown, Pennsylvania. Staying with us for the rest of the hour is Jennifer Brodsky, and waiting in the wings, we have Philip Landis. He operates Sweet Stem Farm with his wife, Dee, and that's in Lititz, Pennsylvania. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. Its magical images have delighted generations. In a concert for families, Yannick Nezet-Séguin leads the Philadelphia Orchestra in scenes from Disney's Fantasia, accompanied by the iconic film and original animated scenes on a giant screen. Mickey Mouse and the Sorcerer's Apprentice, Waltzing Flowers, and more. It's all part of the Stokowski Celebration. Tickets online or 215-893-1999. Saturday, June 23rd at the Academy of Music, Disney's Fantasia in concert.
Hey everybody, Jad here. I wanted to let you know that Radiolab is coming soon to Philadelphia for a live show. We're calling it In the Dark, and it's all about darkness and light, seeing, believing. It's going to be a super fun night because we've got the comedian Dimitri Martin coming with us, the singer-songwriter Tao Nguyen, and the amazing dance troupe, Palabolas. They'll all be there. We'll be there. June 29th at the Academy of Music. You can get tickets at radiolab.org.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. At Fox Chase, molecular medicine helps improve diagnostics for cancer patients. Using the genetic analysis of tumor cells, doctors readily identify the best use of existing cancer drugs and design more effective clinical trials. As DNA sequencing becomes more prevalent in cancer care, Fox Chase is committed to discovering how these methods can best help patients and lead to better outcomes. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase Cancer Center. Hearts plus minds.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're talking about So You Want to Be a Farmer? And our guest, Jennifer Brodsky, here with us in our Philadelphia studios, Managing Director for the Longview Center for Agriculture. It's a project of Greener Partners. Their goal is connecting communities through food, farming, and education. Joining us now is Philip Landis, and he operates Sweet Stem Farm with his wife, D. They raise beef and pork and lamb on 60 acres in Lititz, Pennsylvania, which is in Lancaster County. And Philip Landis, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Yeah, glad to be with you.
So how did you get into farming?
Well, my grandparents were farmers, but my parents really had no interest in farming, and I guess it skips a generation, so okay. I was always interested as a young person, and then kind of had other dreams that came in between, and got back to it when I was a freshman in college. So I studied agriculture at Oregon State University, and really enjoyed the academic part of agriculture, but I enjoy the practical, hands-on, you know, feet in the mud, hands in the dirt part a lot more. So, my wife and I are really committed to raising animals with animal welfare in mind. That's kind of our top priority. So that really fits who we are, and I think it's something that people are really starting to appreciate as well.
Indeed, and I think I heard some of those animals behind you. Are you in your barn now?
I'm actually outside with the sheep. We were doing a little sample taking out here, and I was going to get in the house, but I ran out of time and decided to get under the shade with the sheep.
Well, you are a farmer, right?
That's right.
Now, as you said, you raise your animals. These are free range. You don't use chemicals. Is that correct?
Well, we do use chemicals. I mean, on a limited basis. So we try to, we consider ourselves sustainable, and we try to use a limited amount of herbicide, mm-hmm. for instance, to grow our crops. And compared to a conventional farmer, we'd probably use, a tenth of what they would use. And compared to an organic farmer, of course, they wouldn't use any. But
yeah.
In animal agriculture, it is difficult. I think organic production is exceedingly difficult because there are certain problems we have, like with internal parasites with sheep, for instance, and those require dewormers. And then we've tried some natural and homeopathic things and not had much success with those. But, we do try to minimize the amount of chemical inputs, for sure.
I was reading that I guess your wife comes from a farming family as well. Is that right?
That's right. She grew up on the farm we're on right now.
I love the background noise. I'm getting very distracted, actually, talking with you, Philip. What is your typical day like?
We go out and do chores, and that usually takes four of us maybe 2.5 to 3 hours to get everybody fed, watered, and checked on. We don't, our approach is, we call it a high-touch approach, so mm-hmm. We're out with our animals and really looking at each individual and trying to give it an individualized assessment and individualized care, if that's what it needs. So, we'll feed hay in the morning to some of the sheep, and then we move them on to fresh grass, and we check that everybody wants to come and eat grass, and if they don't want to, why is that? And so this time of year, we have young lambs with their mothers. The mothers are ewes, E-W-E-S.
Yes.
And so there's problems that can come up that we check for, like mastitis. So, we just had a case of that last week. And wow. So, we're just really with our animals a lot, and that's what takes a lot of time.
And that's why you do what you do, yes? To be with the animals?
Yeah, that's why we're doing this. If we weren't raising livestock, we'd probably do something else with animals to make a living, maybe mm-hmm. train dogs or something. I don't know what, but definitely my wife and I both have a strong affinity for animals, and we especially like our sheep, but we also appreciate, you know, having a variety. So we wouldn't want to do just one thing. But we like having the variety is really great for us.
Jennifer, let me get you back in on the conversation from the work that you do. Do you work? This is like the best show ever. but do you work with people like Philip and his wife Dee, raising animals? Is that also part of what you do?
Well, actually, one of the things, as John mentioned before, it's hard to do all of these things really well. So Philip might be able to speak to this better, but there's actually a lack of livestock farmers who are interested in sustainable practices in this area. Herds people are not very easy to come by. So vegetable farming has actually really exploded, and I think there's still really quite a need for professional herdsmen, which I think is a profession unto itself. So we, through the craft program, which we just started, and John had a field day, which I mentioned to you, we have a field day coming up at another organic dairy farm. And we really look towards the entire farming community to allow our apprentices and farmers an opportunity to see these kinds of other operations, but our animal production is minimal right now.
Well, Philip, let me turn back to you in a couple more minutes and we're going to have to say goodbye, but do you see others like yourself, these sort of small-scale farms that are doing the kind of agriculture that you're doing?
A few. I would say it is fairly rare. Mm-hmm. And it depends. Some people's emphasis is organic and some people emphasize animal welfare, and that's, like I said, that's our suit. I do think there, in terms of we have an internship program on our farm, and we find it much more difficult to get interns than it seems like produce people. We know a number of produce farms that farm on a scale similar to ours in terms of acres, and they get 50 to 100 applicants a year, whereas we're much, much lower than that. So I think, certainly people don't think of this right away when they think of sustainable agriculture.
And who are your customers? Who do you sell to?
Well, we sell a number of our products to Whole Foods markets, so you can find our pork and lamb in Whole Foods. Seasonally, we sell to Weaver's Way Co-op and to Martindale's, Fair Food Farm Stand, and the Reading Terminal Market. We do sell all over. We make a delivery to Philadelphia once a week with our products. And I think, honestly, the marketing is still a pretty big challenge. Production is a challenge, but I think the marketing is almost a bigger challenge.
Sure, and obviously you need markets for your animals. And just, staying up with all the things that you could do or that you are available to, or maybe finding out about a restaurant that's interested in the kind of animals that you produce?
Yeah, and the challenge is with marketing, it's not so much that people don't want what we do, it's just that they want pork chops always. They want one thing, and they don't realize that there's a whole other animal, the rest of the animal has to be accounted for. So we can't just, it'd be nice if we had a pig that was just pork chops or bacon or something like that, but we have, another two-thirds of the animal to sell, and so restaurants typically want, the center cuts, and we're kind of a center cut, obsessed culture, if you will. So those middle meats get a lot of attention, and the lesser cuts don't. So we end up having an imbalance there, and that's why it's really helpful. Like, we do our work with Whole Foods and with Sourcemore, with Weaver's Way, they're buying whole animals from us, and that really helps us keep the piles even. Because, for a produce farmer, it's not like if they want to sell you radishes, they insist that you take tomatoes too, but that's kind of our situation.
I hear you. Well, I'm going to let you get back to your lambs, your sheep, your ewes. Thanks so much, Philip Landis, for joining us today on Radio Times.
Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome. Not a problem. And he and his wife, Adi, operate Sweet Stem Farm. It's a farm in Lititz, Pennsylvania, which is in Lancaster County. They raise beef, pork, and lamb on 60 acres, and we heard some of those animals in the background. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me go back to you, Jennifer, because I know there's something you wanted to say about the sort of multiplier effect that these small farms have within a community, the idea of it supports other parts of the economy.
When you asked John if this was a good region to be a farmer, and he said yes, because there were so many supporting operations that if you look at farming and if you look at all small business, obviously a majority of the money is going back into the community. But actually, small farms are unique in that they are the largest amount of the dollar that you spend in a local business goes right back into that direct community. And that's because you're getting your tractor fixed locally. That's because you're buying compost locally. And it's really extraordinary impact, economic impact that I think people haven't, haven't been aware of yet.
Just picking up on what we talked about at the beginning, but are we seeing then more and more either CSA farms or small farms here in the Philadelphia area?
Certainly, yes. Absolutely. I mean, there's been a huge explosion, I think, of CSAs and small farms. It's really exciting.
Let me get some callers in the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. We're talking about farmers and farming and taking calls. And let's get Glenn from Philadelphia to join us. And Glenn, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Well, thank you. And I know Phil's not there, but we love Phil's product.
You have to say who the we is, Glenn, okay?
Oh, Weaver's Way Co-op. I'm
okay,
sorry.
Fair enough. Hi, Glenn.
In the last 10 years, we've seen a real explosion of this in the city and a real desire for people to get involved and organizations like Pennsylvania Horticultural Society, the Food Trust, Fair Food, Farm to City, all are involved in this growth. And what we see, or what I see, is...
Sure.
An economic development, the multiplier effect, as you discussed it before, of taking over both the vacant lands that are here and also land that's available in places like an Orberry Arboretum. We have a 3-acre farm that we operate as a for-profit, but it's really there for education purposes. And we have at least 3,000 visitors a year, children and adults. And at the Saul School, and in Philadelphia, we're very lucky to have the Saul School here, which is one of the largest, if not the largest, urban farm school in the country, with about 80 acres right here. And we have a 3-acre CSA of about 80 shares. Some of them are half shares, so we go to about 120 people. But that helps to sustain at least 6 jobs with health care here in the city of Philadelphia on about 6 acres altogether.
That's great. Well, Glenn, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me see if Jennifer wants to add to that.
I think it's
interesting. Saul sounds like good news.
It absolutely is. And Saul is a wonderful program. And I think that that what I see is that these smaller farms that are starting to operate and have been for several years, I think Weaver's Way has done an amazing job, are really kind of upping the ante and providing more of a customer base for these larger suburban farms that are 60, 100 acres. And I think it's a really nice compliment.
Yeah. Thanks for calling in, Glenn. I know some people that have been associated with CSAs, and I mean, it is complicated. It's not just the farming part, but as you've been talking about, Jennifer, there's, if you want to somehow get connected to the community through education, I mean, I've certainly seen farms that get into the entertainment business as a way to keep going, whether that's a good thing or not. I think that's, in a sense, their choice. But you have to be pretty creative to be a farmer these days.
I really think you do. And I think you also have to be smart about your growth, which is exactly what we were talking about earlier with John, about deciding whether you want to expand beyond vegetable production. And I think you see some of the family farms that have been around for generations really have diversified and have actually started to do a lot of the programming that you're seeing on maybe these smaller, newer farms, where they are doing canning workshops and they are doing pick your own, because people really are asking. They want to be on the farm. They want to reconnect with the people that are growing their food.
Let me get, looks like Douglas from Collegeville. Douglas, to join us on Radio Times. Go ahead. You're on the air, Douglas.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Hi, Doug.
Well, I just wanted to add say hello to Jen, too.
Yes.
You actually have my boss on the show.
Oh, we do. Okay, go ahead, Douglas.
Well, you made a comment earlier about kind of having to divorce the notion of romance from farming. And I just wanted to add that in my prior experience pre-farming, I found that in a lot of jobs I was expending time and energy to sort of create a need, almost convince people that they needed something when they maybe didn't. And with farming, you get this very altruistic feeling where you're creating food. You're creating high-quality food, which is something that every person absolutely needs, wants, deserves. And I find something very satisfying and romantic.
Well, I can understand that, Douglas. And thanks for calling into Radio Times. Jennifer, anything you want to add to that?
I couldn't agree with Doug more, and I think we see that. I see that every day on our farm, and on both of our farms. We have another farm called Hillside in Media as well, that are deeply inspiring places, and the people that work there are passionate and committed and smart and innovative, and they really do feel like, and I think that they are, making a tremendous impact on their community. And there is a romance to that.
Indeed. Douglas, thanks for calling into Radio Times. We're almost out of time here. And it's interesting, we began with Kathleen Merrigan talking about this farmer shortage. And obviously that's an issue not just here, but across the country. And what I'm hearing from you and our other guests is that there is a farming renaissance or resurgence. So it's an interesting sort of contrast.
I really think there is. And I was actually thinking about this on the way here. And I was thinking about some of the farmers that we spoke to today and the boom in apprenticeships that are available. And they're really in some ways taking the place of that mentoring relationship on a traditional family farm. And it's exciting to see. Yeah. I think that the community, the farmers in this region really are quite dedicated to this resurgence. And I think it's a passionate group.
Well, I appreciate the fact that you joined us today in Radio Times. Jennifer Brodsky, thank you so much.
Thank you. I really appreciated being here.
Not a problem. We're happy to have you here. Managing Director for the Longview Center for Agriculture. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us. And